Welcome to Unraveling Midlife. I'm your host, Sarah Spence. Thanks for joining me as I explore my own astrological midlife by speaking with all sorts of inspiring people about their life and work. If you're new to the show, welcome. At the end of the episode, I share a track of my original music. Plus, don't forget to check out the show notes for links mentioned during this episode. Astrological midlife relates to Western astrology transits that run from the mid-30s to the mid-40s for everyone. For some generations, it's the late 30s to the mid-40s. Each of these main midlife transits have an overall theme, though details vary by generation and by individual. It directly corresponds to the term midlife crisis, though I like to call it the midlife unraveling. It can often coincide with a change in direction for people, which is the case with today's guest. Eddie Huperty, Elizabeth McPherson, is an esoteric hypnotherapist, artist, and spiritual and cultural protection agent, amongst other roles. One of these other roles is what we delve into more in this episode, her role as a psychopomp, or death walker. Eddie Huperty shares with us what she does and what we can also do to be more comfortable with the death of our loved ones and options for caring for them at this incredibly special time of their lives. Eddie Huperty, welcome to Unraveling Midlife. It's really awesome to have you here. I've been excited about talking to you and all the varied things that you do and that you gift to the world. Can you tell us a bit about that?
I'll start by introducing myself, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
Aoreki te maunga, ko Waitaki te awa, ko Taki te mutu waka, ko Tuhu Waiaki, ko Tangata, ko Kaitahu, ko Kati Mamu e toku iwi. Ko Eddie Huperty, Elizabeth McPherson, aho. As I've just said, I'm of Kaitahu and Kati Mamoe descent. So my whānau are from the bottom of the South Island. I grew up in the bottom of the South Island. And from quite a large, a big family. A big family from many big families, but quite isolated from my family. So I, as a child, I look back on my childhood and realize that I've always been an altar builder. I've always looked for meaning in my arrangements, which is probably where my art stems from. I have always created. I've always been a creator. Currently, mostly working in bone and stone and black and white prints. That's what I do in the room next door. So I'm currently living in Old Eddie in Collingwood in Golden Bay. And I have this amazing whare that you have been and visited called Te Whare o Hinei Ohu One. So it's a healing space in both rooms. I have a treatment room that I'm sitting and talking to you from, and I have a studio where I create artwork from. And most of my artwork has a spiritual theme or drive behind it. I'm not just creating pretty things for the sake of creating pretty things. Most of them are what I'm working through personally, or what I see the world working through at the time. So alongside creating artwork, I see clients in many different aspects. I work as an esoteric hypnotherapist primarily now. I'm a rongoā practitioner, a miri-miri and a romi-romi practitioner. Just to explain those three terms, rongoā is medicine made from plants. Miri-miri is energetic work. And romi-romi is the physical massage, which I don't do a lot of anymore, except for very special. And I work as a spiritual and cultural protection agent. That means I go into places like museums and businesses to make sure that the people working there are kept safe spiritually and culturally. So I work alongside with tikanga, and not just with tikanga Māori, but with more in tune with the vibrational humanity than just that limited, you know, te ao Māori is a massive worldview, but the tikanga rules can be a little bit simplistic for some of the situations that I work in.
I was just wondering if someone's listening from another country, is there an easy way of describing tikanga?
Tikanga kind of translates basically as the rules of safety that we practice to keep ourselves and others spiritually safe. So tikanga can be very simple things such as we don't sit on tables where food is prepared. We don't put our hats on. We don't put our hats or things that belong on our head on tables. Our head is sacred, so hats and hairbrushes don't belong on tables. We don't step over another person's feet because we are interfering with spiritual energy. There's a multitude of minor tikanga or rules that are followed by both Māori and European people in our country, such as always introducing ourselves. And we introduce ourselves, as I did earlier, by stating my first ancestor is my mountain. So my mountain is Auraki or Mount Cook. So that's part of tikanga, is I always say my ancestors come first, and my first ancestor is Auraki. So those are kind of the basics of it, kind of the rules of the Indigenous people of Aotearoa New Zealand. And there's a lot of those that cross over with basic spiritual hygiene that is practiced by all cultures. So I do a bit of that work, which quite often takes me away from home and into the big city, which is always an interesting experience when I live quite remotely. The other job that I do that I've been doing for a very long time, I've been working as a psychopomp or a death walker since the age of 23. That's a few moons ago now. And that's probably the most important part of my focus at this stage of my life. It's become more since that Saturn opposition, that greater responsibility time around 2014, it kind of became a larger piece rather than just prior to that, I did a lot of births. I did a lot of seeing people into the world. I don't get called to births anymore. It's mostly the deaths that I'm working with. So just to kind of explain how that came about is I started practicing ritual at the age of 17, ordering witchcraft books from back in the olden days when there was no internet, it was just weird catalogues that you found in the back of health magazines, and I taught myself ritual practices, particularly the solar festivals. And it wasn't until about 1999 that I came across a spiritual teacher in person and expanded my knowledge and started a temple of my own in around about 2000, and I ran that temple for a long time.
When you say it's a temple, what kind of temple?
A temple, so the temple itself was called Tamsu Parari Ren, which means the temple of the Queen of Paradise. So what that meant was a group of people, not just women. I don't run women's groups, because being the mother to two boys, it's important for me that my children have learned through being able to be access the rites and rituals that we practiced as a group. So people were initiated into the temple, which normally meant an apprenticeship with me of a year and a day. And I think probably there was somewhere in the vicinity of maybe 30 or 40 people who undertook that rite of passage. And they helped me do the multitude of rituals that I was called upon to do through that 20-year time frame of everything from baby blessings, prenatal rites, baby blessings, house blessings, house clearings, rites of passage for boys at the age of 13, Menaka rites for girls when they first start menstruating, so many others. So I had a group of people that I trained so that they could all do that, so they could learn to write ritual, so they could learn to I believe that there's a misconception that's come up due to religion that we need to be special to bless one another. And I believe that we're all capable of blessing. So that was really what I was teaching, was that we are capable of blessing one another. We're capable of blessing one another formally within the ritual. You don't have to have a special qualification or a special badge or a cape or a hood or anything. We're all capable of blessing one another. So that's what I taught for a long time. And yeah, that was an amazing experience. We did a lot of public ritual. So we would do the Sabbaths publicly on Waiheke Island. Sometimes we'd have 40 people, sometimes 300 or 400 people, which was pretty amazing to have 30 or 40 drummers and hundreds of people all singing to call and respond songs. Because it's nature-based practice, people of all religious creeds and denominations felt comfortable to come.
What kind of songs did you do?
Lots of We All Come From the Goddess, or lots of Te Reo Māori songs, you know, Te Aroha, mm-hmm. songs about love that everybody can really tune into, really, really tune into. There's so many wonderful, Isis Astarte, Diana is one that we sang for years and years. So every Wednesday was ritual practice for many years, and we would gather at somebody's house and we would learn all the songs that we needed, and we would practice the ritual that was it's only kind of 8 weeks between each solar festival. There's eight of them. There's not a lot of time frame between them. Sometimes we would hire out the local halls on Waiheke, and they would be public occasions. Other times we would kind of just keep it to the core ritual group and do very elaborate, beautiful rituals, which were, yeah, they were pretty magical when I look back on that time. Part of my drive for doing that was because my oldest child, Kahukura, I wanted them to experience life in a village where Christianity was not at the heart of communing with others. So they never had Christmas or Easter or any of those celebrations. They celebrated the solstice, and it's pretty hard to take your kids trick-or-treating in May the 1st when it is actually, because we're in the southern hemisphere, you know, our Halloween or Samhain is occurs 1st of May or around that time. It's pretty hard to take your kids trick-or-treating at that time. It doesn't go down very well. So, you know, we managed to keep those practices very uplifting for our children. Quite a big group of us with children the same age who all gave our children that experience of being in community and following the cycles of nature as opposed to the cycles of retail outlets. I have asked my oldest child whether or not they feel like they missed out by not having Easter or Christmas, and their response was that they were pretty happy because they knew I'd never told them the Easter Bunny lie or the Santa Claus lie. They knew that I always told them the truth. So that's pretty delightful.
Oh, I love it. Oh, wow. Wow. Wow, that sounds incredible. And how did your life move on from celebrating or performing the rituals of the solar festivals?
I had a second child later in life. I was 41 when I had my youngest, and I decided to move from one end of the country, halfway down to the middle of the country, in order to refocus my life. I was a pretty very public figure, both as an artist and as the swamp witch, which I was called for years because I was the houseboat in the swamp. I was called on a lot in my first child's childhood. I was often out at births or deaths or attending rituals for that people required. And I wanted my second child to have quite a different experience. So we moved into the middle of nowhere when he was a few weeks old. And I presumed that in my absence that the ritual group would continue under its own steam, having given that information freely to all who attended. That didn't occur. Apparently there needs to be a train driver. I'm sure you know that one.
Mm.
I switched to online and ran a group online, which is still active, but I don't put quite the same amount of focus on it. A group called Virtual Coven that is online. I still share rituals for all of the Sabbaths group, and anyone's welcome to just on Facebook. Anyone's welcome to request access to Virtual Coven. There's some amazing files and rituals that are available in there. I used to make ritual packs for years and send them out into the and then I undertook the rite of the 12 Seas Regents for medicine, shamanic and esoteric study. And I really had a change in my focus of being able to do spiritual activism without having to be responsible for everybody else's spiritual hygiene.
That would be a real blessing with your background.
It really was an amazing shift to focus solely on my own practice again.
Yeah, it's hard to describe that course. I'm nodding because I've done it myself, so I understand the depth and transformation that it can hold. Not sure how to describe it.
It's just such a powerful it's such a powerful drawing together of so many of those ancient knowledges and creating practical ways to draw that knowledge into your life. Connecting with the celestial regents is quite nothing quite like that. You know, we can learn the We can learn the we can learn our astrology. We can learn about the planets and their effects, but to have that course teach us what it does teach us, very different.
I had a question from someone I know from learning astrology, where I learn, and she asked about that, and I said, well, it's just an amazing course, because at the very least, you get to the feeling of embodiment of a planet or a zodiacal sign or house. And it was that feeling, like the week I did Venus, that I was sashaying as I walked through the lounge, or when I did Mars, that I was feeling angry, and I don't like feeling angry. So I had to feel angry that week, because that's what was happening. And actually that happened a bit with the sun as well. And, you know, yeah, years on, I'm like, oh, of course. Well, you know, Mars and Aries and the sun, they've both kind of got Mars's exalted or in its strength. So it was a really, really interesting how the feeling of those had a different meaning than what I expected intellectually.
I think when we embody it beyond our ego, which is the intellect, the knowledge, we have all this knowledge, it really makes you understand that we don't know anything.
Mm-hmm.
But mm-hmm. we can feel and we can embody what it means, what it means to connect with Venus, what it means to embody Venus. And all of those mansions of life, to understand that the ninth mansion of life is a place where our focus is on journeys and the search for meaning in our life. We can understand what those words mean, but to have every cell, muscle, and fiber of your being vibrate to that very high frequency is such a different experience.
I feel like I want to do that course again now. I've studied astrology five years. You know, it's
like, yeah. I have often thought I would like to go back and do those courses again, because now I know more. Now I know more, and I know less.
Mm-hmm.
I know that I know nothing. I know that I know so little. But that embodiment is such a different experience from, you know, looking at the words, understanding the language, kind of getting your own feeling for what Venus means, what Neptune means, what Uranus means. That's a very different experience to being in deep communion with those energies that are really, truly powerful forces. And we have the capacity to choose to connect in with them.
Yes.
That was life-changing. The Rite of the 12 Celestial Regents and the Ritual of the 12 Gates, those two medicine women, Center for Shamanic and Esoteric Studies courses, were above and beyond any reading or any other courses that are done to learn and understand astrology.
So the ninth house being purpose, maybe we like dial it back to the eighth house, which part of that mention of life is around death. I'd love to hear a little bit more about your death walker work, what and that entails now, and even what it used to entail, whatever you're comfortable with sharing. Because
I'm very comfortable with sharing information about this, because I had a session with our teacher just after one of the Tohara events, the most recent Tohara, wasn't a medicine woman retreat, but it was a very powerful a feeling that welled up in me that I no longer want to be the only one responsible for the knowledge that I have around this process. It was never something that I thought that I would be engaged with, And my first experience of death was I was 6 years old and a neighbour had a heart attack. And I knelt on the floor and held his head in my hands. And I saw the life leave his body. And I saw him hanging around. And that was not scary at all. It was not frightening to me at all. It was just, oh, that's what happens. That's what happens. I was very young, probably a bit young to be frightened. I hadn't been to funerals or that prior to that experience. My first experience of being asked to attend a death, I was 23, which is pretty young, really, to start that sort of practice. I had a one-year-old. I needed a lot of uffy from my, a lot of support from my circle of friends in order to allow me to take part in that process. A woman in her 40s dying of cancer, 3 children, a family really unable to accept her death. So there was a lot of fractious energy in the house around her. She'd called on me. I didn't know her personally. She was a friend of a friend and asked me to help her through her death process. And I went, okay then, I have no idea what I'm doing, but sure, I'll be there to support you through that journey. And just before, she'd been unconscious for a number of days, and I'd been sitting at her bedside on and off for about 4 or 5 days, more to keep the whānau, keep the family from say acting out, but not being able to contain themselves because of their grief. And she had not spoken for 3 or 4 days, and she opened her eyes and looked, John's head again. And about 20 minutes later, she died. And I looked after her body. That was my first real experience as a conscious adult, as a conscious being of the need for people to be helped to cross over. Because there's such a, there has been, it's very much changing now, there has been such a negative view on death. It's been so hidden. It's been sullied somehow by the Western view of bodies being dirty or yuck or and after that it just led to me for 11 years straight I had constant engagement with people actively dying, people going birth. So now my process is quite different. People formally engage with me often. I am known in my community as someone who is available, particularly to families who don't have the finances to engage a funeral director. I feel the need for sharing the information that we are all capable of blessing each other, including through death, including through that final journey. So we make, generally make the caskets. I have family help to make caskets, and often I line them with a favorite blanket or a quilt. Quite often they're created before the person dies, sometimes quite in advance. I'll get the family members, sometimes the person themselves, to weave the handles of the casket out of karakeke, out of New Zealand native flax. And really personalize the experience, not just for the person who is heading off, but also for the family members. It's quite a powerful form of acceptance to weave the candles for your beloved's casket. And we have a truck that acts as a hearse, a really old truck that fits a coffin on the back of it. So when somebody dies, quite often I'm with people as they're dying. I know who to contact. They'll say, okay, you can go ahead. Because there's legalities around this stuff. There's still the basic legalities of having to have a doctor declare death before you move someone. So I will wash and dress people and sit with them for 3 days. I'll do all the paperwork for crematorium and the burial services and see that process through. I do the services, celebration of life, whatever people want to call it.
Could you just repeat?
Yeah, I do the rituals around death, which include, you know, quite often a service similar to a funeral. We do a lot of clearing houses, house blessings after the tūpapaku or the body has been taken out of the house. Because we live relatively remote, using our old dunga of a truck to transport coffins. Sometimes people's houses are too small to have a gathering in, so that happens in my living room, which is a pretty interesting experience for my children, as you can imagine. They're so used to it that they're not complacent about it at all, but they're quite used to the fact that sometimes there's somebody they don't know and whānau they don't know, families they don't know, who will sleep in the living room alongside their loved one. Because that's becoming quite accepted outside of the world of te ao Māori, outside of that Māori worldview. It's becoming quite accepted that the soul hangs around for a few days afterwards, and it's nice not to leave that person unattended until they've really crossed over that bridge. So, that's not a job I get paid to do. That's a job that I do voluntarily, and sometimes I'm given a kōpā. Kōpā meaning a gift or a donation. Sometimes I'm not. I don't really have any attachment to that. Life all sorts itself out. And it's always a privilege to watch the transition, the changes that happen in the souls of those who walk alongside me as I do that work. The families who do that in that way to take care of their own loved one, who are with me as I wash and dress them, who are with me through the process of building a casket, who have input as to where we're going to celebrate, how we're going to celebrate, what photographs we're going to use, what poems are going to be read. People change dramatically. People change dramatically in the way that they view not just their own mortality, but the sacredness of those around them, which is as payment in itself.
So that sounds really attractive, attractive, maybe not the right word.
It does sound really attractive. I know exactly what you're saying.
It does sound really attractive if, you know, you've got aging parents or someone who's near end of life and you want to be able to attend to them without that. I can't quite find the word bleakness. Bleakness is what springs to mind of sending someone to a funeral parlor and having them embalmed and talking with a funeral director. I'm just thinking of the one for my grandmother who, you know, that kind of thing with no personal connection. Like, there isn't a personal connection. And clearly,
it's not loving.
No.
As for me, that's my, the simplest way I can put it is it's not loving. It's not, but unless we're led, unless we know what to do, how do we go about doing that?
And how do we go about doing that? Because clearly you live remotely and you're not going to be able to come and attend people all over the country, all over the world yourself.
I have done a lot of traveling recently for deaths, mostly within Aotearoa. But I do think that obviously the laws vary between countries, but one of the main things that is a major misconception for most people is that the paperwork is that a funeral director has to do the paperwork. That's not true. The funeral directors closely guard the paperwork, and it can be very difficult to get the government forms that you require in order to do this yourself. But the death cafes that are all over the world are places where you can find support for that.
And so
people are in
clarity, death cafe not being a physical place but gatherings of people talking about death.
Yes, yeah. Gatherings of people talking about death. I know that there's one here in Golden Bay. I haven't attended it. I'm not a very public person.
Good that you came on this.
Just for you. I haven't attended a death cafe talk myself, but I do understand. I belong to some of the groups online. There's some great information being shared there, and that's the sort of information you can find there. If there's people in Aotearoa, New Zealand, I have the paperwork. It's an email that I can send through. One of the things that I'd really like to talk about in this, which is really important, is if you want to be cremated, which is a much better option, personally, than taking up land, particularly if you're going to be embalmed. Anyway, that's a whole nother rant. there is a simple form that can be filled out, well in advance. A number of years ago, my friends and I gathered together on New Zealand, and we all filled out our forms. The forms include things like your mum and dad's names and your grandfather's names. Now, that's not something that everybody would know about you. It's not something that everybody would know about me. So that having that information written down is really valuable. The other thing that's a really valuable tool within this country, and I'm sure that they're available in other countries as well, is there's a booklet that you can get through the medical centres or hospitals called End of Life Care Plan, which has some really good questions in it. It's a booklet that needs to be kept updated, but it has questions about what you would like to happen if you are actively dying and you can't speak for yourself, who you would like to speak for you. It has questions regarding what your religious requirements are. It has questions regarding who you would like to take care of your body, who your power of attorney is, all of those sorts of things. And it's a really great document, and they are free in New Zealand.
I believe that, well, I've seen an advanced care plan, and there was a section in that with end of life, and I wonder if it's the same, because it sounds like the same questions that are included in the advanced care, which is also a really good thing to do.
It's a really good thing to do, because they, you know, there's two things that are certain in life: death and taxes. Can't escape either of them. That's a Terry Pratchett quote.
I didn't know that that was a Terry Pratchett quote.
Yeah, that's a Terry Pratchett quote.
I've heard it so many times and now I know where it comes from.
Yeah, he's my favourite author. There's those simple things that we can do, those discussions that we can have with our parents. Hey, mum, I know that there's nothing wrong with you now, but how would you feel about sitting down with me and filling out an end-of-life care plan? Because I want to know how I can look after you if you get sick or if something happens to you. Because people can have heart attacks out of the blue. People can have strokes and not be able to speak. I do think that it's a great thing to sit down and do with our family members to ensure that a couple of things. It keeps us safe as practitioners, as though the holders of space. It keeps us safe. I sat with a lovely kuia, an elder, female elder, and her youngest son, and went through her end-of-life care plan, and she expanded that out to what she wants her tangi or her funeral to look like, where she wants to spend the first night after she dies, where she wants to spend the second night, who she wants to carry her casket, what she wants to wear. Everything was is written down, and I hold that information for that family, which means there's not a lot of decisions to be made for her loved ones when she dies.
That's which is brilliant.
It's so helpful. It's so helpful. It's because, such a great thing to do.
I mean, just you talking about who carries the casket, I come from a really small family. Well, I can't carry it by myself.
No, it's a wonderful gift that she is giving her family to go, this is how I want it. You know, and a lot of people go, oh, I don't want a funeral. If you are going to have a funeral, be like, you know, we know those questions. Yeah. We know how to ask those questions.
I feel like the funeral's for the living, those left behind.
The funeral is for the living. It's and the healing. A lot of the time, yeah, that's where the healing happens. That's where acceptance happens. And we do have to accept that, you know, that our loved one has gone, and that eventually we all go the same way. And to embrace it and accept it as a loving kindness that we offer our loved ones the relief of not having to make those decisions when they are distressed.
Absolutely.
Is a really beautiful thing. I mean, I've been in some situations where I've had to be in charge of making all the decisions because, you know, sudden deaths, young people dying in car accidents, for example, those are times when families can't make decisions. So I will make the decisions. That's a real rarity.
Mm.
A lot of the time, particularly with people who know that they have a limited time left to live, there's time to have those discussions. There is time to have those talks. And there's time for us all to have those talks. There's time for people our age to have those discussions, to write down what it is that we'd like. I'd like to have Ding Dong the Witch is Dead played at my funeral. And a Ouija board so people can contact me if they've got any last things to say. No, but you know, to actually have a plan, regardless of the fact I don't have anything wrong with me, I'm not dying, but my family knows what I would like.
Well, my mum keeps changing which song she wants me to sing, and I keep going, okay, if we're going to talk about your death, am I actually going to be able to get through a song without crying?
You'll be really surprised. You're really good at holding space for people, so you probably will be. Really? There is that place that we go to, and that is something else that's really important to talk about, that when we think that we're going to be so broken and devastated by the loss of our loved ones that we won't be able to wash them and dress them. The reality is that I've witnessed for the last 30 years is people can do it. They want to do it. It feels right. It's a beautiful, loving act to wash your loved one. to dress them. It's not something that is, it's not something that is to be avoided or scary. It's not something that people generally, strangely enough, there's usually a lot of laughter during those times.
Do you find a difference between different cultures? I'm just thinking of, you know, like this, the British Isles, stiff upper lip, and, you know.
There is, but at the same time, there are, the more that those stiff upper lip types see the beauty of someone being cared for in that way, the more their minds are open, the more their soul is open to the potential of, I want to be cared for like that. I want to be loved like that. We all want to be loved. That's a basic human reality, is we want to be loved. And there is nothing more loving than holding space for somebody who has just died. There's nothing more loving than that. It's such a beautiful time, regardless of whether it's a shocking death, a sudden death, an unexpected death. It changes people's souls to be able to act in a loving way to one another and to their loved one. It's a really beautiful experience to undertake that. From a perspective of watching people who, I had a family a year or so ago, not quite a year ago, who had a young member of their family killed in what we thought was a car accident. It turned out that he had something wrong with his heart, which caused the car accident. And they are very, very farmy type people, really not spiritually engaged, not interested in spiritual engagement. Their whole lives were changed because they chose to go through that process. They chose to do that process instead of, well, they didn't know what to do. So I was like, okay, let's do this. They're changed people. They're much kinder and loving towards one another now. They're much better at expressing their emotions. They're much better at accepting help. They are, yeah, they're changed people for that experience. And we don't have to wait until someone we love dies to have those conversations. We can do it as soon as possible. And somebody keeps the records. Somebody is the record holder.
In my experience, it sometimes can take quite a few times broaching the conversation. It took about 6-7 years to get some of that end of care, end of life plan recorded.
Particularly for that, the generation born in, between the 40s and 50s, it can be really confronting for them to even be asked those questions. But if we keep doing it in a kind and loving way, there's how else would they want to be loved? How else would they want to be cared for? That's if we come from that place, which is a Tony Wilder quote, love is the answer to every question. If we keep going back and saying, I love you so much that I want to get this right for you, please help me do that. Instead of coming from I need to sort this out, this needs to be done, just look, mum, look, dad, I love you so much that I want to do this right for you in a way that upholds your mana, that upholds your spirit. Can you help me do that? Instead of, it becomes not a task, but a loving act.
So this is like a taster of what's possible. Are you ever potentially going to widen this on a kind of a more formal basis, do you think?
Yes, I have written a program that I'm intending to offer early next year to teach people. There's a number of death doula courses out there online that are very good. That's not what I'm offering. I'm offering people the opportunity to take care of their family, not to do it as a job. You know, this is a century ago, this wasn't, 150 years ago, it wasn't a job. It's just what we did for our loved ones. And what I would like to teach people, which I do, you know, I have taught at local marae, at local Māori meeting houses. This is how we do it. I had the wonderful experience of writing a document in a very short space of time. I was asked to go and speak at St. John. A family member is a first responder, and they wanted to learn more about the tikanga, or the rules around death, or tangi. Tangi hanga is the Māori word. They wanted to learn more about it from somebody who does it, and I wrote a little booklet for them. And when I wrote that booklet, I realised that it's not a te ao Māori. It's not about te ao Māori. It's not about segregating ourselves by tribes through our death practices, but for every person to understand that they are capable of doing this. If you can feed your babies and wash your babies, you can do it for your elders when they pass. There's no difference. It's just it's the same love.
You're just a bit heavier.
They're just a bit heavier. Need a couple of extra people. So one of the things that I'd really like to teach is how to move somebody. How to move somebody. How to move a body. Because those things are things that people don't know.
Unless they were a healthcare assistant with living.
You'll know how to do it then. And how to wash people's hair when they are dying. Those sorts of little things which are good tricks to know. So that we can... There's nothing as sacred as washing someone before they die. Nothing that I've ever experienced that is that sacred, of touching someone in a loving manner in service to that soul. And there's a lot to be said being in service in a loving manner. Not expecting anything back from it.
So if people are interested in learning how to take care of their family, are you taking email addresses or something like that?
Yes, people are welcome to contact me through my website. My website, it's pretty easy to remember, and there's a bit of information on my website regarding this. It's www.eri.nz. So yeah, people are welcome to contact me, because I do have digital files that are helpful. I do have those things for Aotearoa New Zealand that people require, and it is something that I when I had a session with our teacher that I mentioned before, I had this real feeling of being weighted down by being the only person I know who knows this information. I don't want that. I want this information to be shared. I want us to go back to the old practices of we look after our own. That they're not, funeral directors are great. I know some lovely ones, but the opportunity even to work alongside a funeral director and know how to do that, to know how to say, hey, I want to dress my mum. I don't want you to do her makeup. I don't want him to be embalmed, whatever it is. But there's, because there's a lot of questions around those things where we're told by funeral directors. For example, when my mother died about 10 years ago, even though I've been doing this work, she died further down the country, and my brother was there and in charge, and I was on a three-way call, and the funeral director convinced him to have her embalmed. There was no need for her to be embalmed. It's not necessary. That was something that was invented to help bring bodies back from war so that they were acceptable when they returned. That was something that occurred during, I think maybe the American Civil War even, I can't remember, but there's history there relating to that needing to transport bodies back from battlefields back to their loved ones.
So I know.
So we don't need to do that.
I've heard of natural funeral homes that cool, have the bodies stored cool, but you're saying that we can keep them
at, we can do that at home. We do that at home with, you know, bags of ice. Put a blanket over the top of the bags of ice. We keep our loved ones cool, keep their tummies cool particularly. And there's no, it's not as terrifying as what we are taught, what we're led to believe.
And then,
I know not everybody is capable of it.
True.
Not everybody believes that they're capable of it. Right? If you have physical limitations, it would be difficult for you, but it is possible to be supported to do it regardless of your circumstances. It is even just implanting the seed in people's minds that it's a potential that they are capable of themselves would be a good start.
Wow. There's a bit to think about and feel into, I'm sure, for some people. Yeah.
And, you know, just keep going back to that statement of Anthony Weiber's of love is the answer to every question. Really important statement to remember in and around times of dying and in and around times of birth. Because it's all that we all want.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that. And again, the website's www.eri.nz. And what I love is that we didn't even touch on your jewelry making, and we touched a little bit on your art, but and your sacred perfume, and a lot of that can be checked out on the website. And
yeah,
esoteric hypnotherapy, all of that stuff. But yeah, you can contact Eddie for more information on working with death. Thank you so much for sharing that. Is there anything as a last note you'd like to add? Just that quote?
That quote, love is the answer to every question. It really is, in and around those times, those transition times, all transition times. That's the motto that runs through my mind a lot.
I also know that another one from that tradition, love faileth never.
Love faileth never.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Hiri Hapiti.
You're so welcome. So lovely to see you.
Welcome to the music section. I mostly include a piece of original music at the end of each show. Often, like many, I end up quite busy, and so recording any new music doesn't always fit into life easily. For this month's edition, the song is from the yogic tradition in a style of music called kirtan that is designed for call and response group singing. We delved into this in episode 10 with Joshna Lovetrobe. The words Kali Durge Namo Nama call upon the goddesses Kali and Durga, known for their relation to death and the fierceness that comes with the transformation of self. I admit that it's a loose association with the style of transition that we discussed in the interview. However, self-transition, transformation, is a form of love, and love is the answer to every question. Feel free to sing along and observe if there is a change to your emotional or mental state afterwards. Kali Durge Ma. Kali. Unraveling Midlife is brought to you from Aotearoa New Zealand by www.sarahmarlowspence.com. Theme music is by Sarah Marlow Spence and Saraswati Marie Willis, and art by Samantha Hepburn.